Welcome back to Open Line, WOSU 820, NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, why are so many of us so fat? And it's not just us Americans who are overweight. My guest this hour, nutrition scholar Barry Popkin, says that obesity is a problem of epidemic proportions around the world. My guest says our global economy has shaped our health and well-being and everyday lives in many ways for the better. But he says our biology is shaped by millions of years of evolution. It's not prepared for our modern society, which has profoundly changed, he says, how we eat, drink, and move. We'll find out more. Barry Popkin is professor of global nutrition at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and director of the university's Interdisciplinary Obesity Center. His new book is The World is Fat. It's subtitled The Fads, Trends, Policies, and Products That Are Fattening the Human Race. Welcome to Open Line, Barry Popkin. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much.
And we're at 614-292-8513. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email brief comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. Barry, so it's not just Americans who are overweight or obese. This is a worldwide epidemic, and that I find quite astonishing.
Yeah. And what's most astonishing to people can expect that, okay, people in the UK, Australia, other high-income countries are overweight. But if you go next door to Mexico and you find that there are equal numbers overweight and obese there as there are in the U.S., you go to Egypt, what we think of as a really poor country, South Africa, you find equal numbers. Two-thirds of adults in all of those countries are overweight. And among around the 20 to 30 countries with over half of the adults overweight and over 20 to 25% of children overweight, half of them are what we would call low-income countries. Hmm. Countries like Bolivia, Peru, countries in Asia. China went from no overweight when I first started doing research there in the 80s to close to a third of adults overweight today. This is becoming a global shift and how people eat, drink, and move.
I guess, I visited China extensively in the early 1980s, and I noticed how thin people were, and I guess if I went back today, that would be different.
You betcha. You would see little kids there that look, unfortunately, so different than the chubby boys and girls that we see in our country.
Well, how can a country which we think of as having low income, naturally you think of malnutrition, you think of underweight, how can they become overweight?
Yeah, and it's so quick. So how does it happen? Well, first, in China, they conquered hunger very successfully in the 80s. When I started doing my large-scale surveys there, they had actually less hunger than we had almost. And they had lower levels of low birth weight. So what they did was, as all of a sudden they opened up their markets to international products and people got more income and the food supply really exploded when they opened up farmers to growing whatever they wanted, people changed drastically and rapidly what they were eating and drinking. And modern technology started entering as China got more income and people started moving less. And it was this combination. I can go through each piece very carefully if you'd like, or just take the movement part.
Well, let's look at China in the 80s compared to China now, for example. If I looked at the diet of the average Chinese person in the 80s and the diet now, what would I see as a difference?
Okay. In the 80s, the Chinese ate a lot of vegetables, and they ate a lot of beans. Mung beans, soybeans, mm-hmm. many products like that. And they had a small amount of fish or poultry or pork, but really small amounts.
Yes.
They drank water.
Yep.
That's it. Other than breastfeeding, it was water they mm-hmm. drank. So that was how they lived then. Today, in terms of moving, they villages and cities allowed everyone to bike. When I went there, I biked all over Beijing. That's
yep.
how you got around.
Me too. That's right. Yeah.
You couldn't actually find cars and cabs and so on very easily. Today, it's first, kids are outlawed under the age of 12 from biking in China. In the cities, it's too dangerous to bike for anyone. In many areas, in many cities, they ban it. They still allow it, but it's getting more and more difficult. Children don't bike. People take buses. They take motorcycles. And they don't walk half as much as they used to. So that's one thing. At work, they now have a lot of technology. If you're a farmer, you have these little tiny cheap tractors that little tiny things that cost $50, $100, and they use those. They don't carry their produce to the market now. They have buses and tractors to take it in. They, at work, everybody, at home, TV is everywhere. TV went from horrible TV that only a third of people had televisions on in the 1890s, 1980s, to today, everybody has color TV, and they have all the TV channels we have here in the U.S. So they shifted on their TV. They shifted in how they move at work, and even at home, they now have over half the people have refrigerators, two-thirds have stoves. They no longer do the same cooking, shopping, preparing they did before. It's become much simpler. So movement has drastically changed, but now they have all the caloric beverages. They don't drink as much as we do yet, but it's starting. They had no snacks in the 80s. Today, a quarter of Chinese snack, and it's just a drastic shift. And what are they snacking on? The same kinds of fried junk food we have. If you go to any big city in China, you will find a Carrefour, which is the equivalent of Walmart. It's the French version of Walmart. Mm-hmm. A Walmart or a Chinese equivalent, you'll find they have access to all the kinds of foods and beverages we do. You'll find that the Chinese went from consuming tiny amounts of oil, vegetable oil, and all of a sudden it's really cheap, and they consume on an average 300 calories a day. They quadrupled their meat intake. It's still tiny by our standards, but they really, at a time when they should have been cutting their calories, they started eating more and more richer food, and they went from three meals to three and a half. And they went from water to all these new beverages, milk even, or what have you, but it's all adding calories. So mm-hmm. all of these changes are not just China. China's just, Mexico, it's even more amazing.
Yes, go ahead.
I'll give you one tiny example.
Yeah.
I've lived and was involved because of a partner of mine. She worked in Chiapas in a village there for 30 years. And when I went there early on, they had, in the 90s, they had no roads. They were very isolated. They were very healthy. I mean, they weren't heavy. They ate beans and tortillas. They made their tortillas by hand and so forth. You go back today, they got a highway in there. They have electricity. They have these little shops all over the place selling soft drinks, all soft drinks. You go to a celebration at a family house today, they give you a two-liter bottle of Coke, each person to drink for each meal. And it's just drastic. TV is there. All the men are very fat, and they're beginning to get diabetes.
I remember the meals I saw cooked in China in the early 80s in people's homes, and they were sautéed, you know, vegetables with very little oil. Meat, as you say, was very little. And I remember there weren't fast food places, at least in the early 80s, in the sense that we have them. I remember on July 4th in the early 80s when we were there, the big treat at the American Embassy was they flew in McDonald's cooks and burgers from Hong Kong because there weren't any in China. And I imagine that's all changed.
Yes, that's completely changed. But it's not American fast food that have done this. It's not Walmart per se. It's kind of modernization and bringing in a new food supply, and their increased income and cheap prices of all these things getting cheaper and cheaper, and it's that combination that's done it. They don't eat a lot away from home yet, but snacking is the first change. Only in the big cities do you see the people starting to eat much more away from home, but it's tiny. We spend over half of our dollar on food eaten away from home and at least another quarter on food prepared away that we eat at home. They spend 4% of what they on away from home.
Mm-hmm. Barry Popkin, nutrition scholar from the University of North Carolina, is my guest. His new book is The World is Fat. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. Barry, as a result of these trends, you say we have an astonishing number of 1.6 billion, with the B, approximately more than 1.6 billion people overweight and obese. And, of course, an explosion of diabetes and also hypertension.
That's absolutely correct. And the rate of increase of overweight and obesity among adults across the globe is every year an extra 1% of adults are getting overweight and obese, and an extra half to two-thirds of a percent of all the children. We are adding hundreds of millions per year new overweight. We were seeing a decrease we're down to around 700 to 800 million hungry and malnourished people, predominantly in South Asia and India and in sub-Saharan Africa. That's kind of slowed down with the world food crisis right now, the decline in that. But we haven't seen the increases in that. So what has really happened is even in those countries, as modern technology hits people, as some things like vegetable oils and sugary products all become cheaper, everybody wants to live that way. Mm-hmm. And the modern technology makes a lot of people's lives simpler. TV is accessible to people, even in the most remote places. And they use it and they watch it, and so kids don't play outside. There are just lots of these subtle little changes that change our lives. It's kind of like in the U.S., people start using a TV clicker, and every time they would have got up and sat down, they'd have burned some calories.
That's
they
right,
don't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Kids text each other. They don't even talk to each other. They don't even get up and talk to them when they're 100 feet apart. So these tiny little changes have so accumulated to affect people's lives, and they're good in many ways. People don't want to do backbreaking work. No one wants to lift huge tons. Everybody wants a forklift or some way to plow the soil that's automatic. So I don't blame the globe for wanting to have an easier life, and I don't blame the globe for wanting to have sweeter things to consume and fattier things. The problem is our biology isn't equipped for it.
Where does our biology – I was about to ask the question the wrong way. Where does our biology fall short? It's not our biology that's falling short. It's the way we're dealing with it.
That's right. Let's talk about beverages because it's the simplest example. When you think back thousands and tens of thousands of years ago, up till 10,000 years ago, we actually didn't even consume caloric beverages other than breast milk. So for hundreds of thousands of years, as we evolved into the modern man we are today, we consumed breast milk for a couple years of life and then water. And that was it. And if you don't drink after 3 days, you die. If you don't eat food, you don't die for a month. And food was very seasonal. So our system developed that our thirst mechanisms were separated from our hunger mechanisms. So what that means is if I give you water, or all of a sudden I change and I give you a Pepsi, you don't change your food intake. So that would be okay if we kept consuming water. But in the last 10,000 years, we started developing these new beverages. We didn't consume much. The Romans diluted their wine 4-to-1, 3-to-1. They had very little. They used it to kill the bacteria. People did this throughout history. Only a few times did people consume much milk or any beverage in any major amount, but up to just like 100, 200 calories. All of a sudden, you go to 1950, that's how we drank. A little beer, some milk. I grew up in Wisconsin. People in the Midwest, kids always had milk. We got it free at school, 4 ounces, and we drank it for breakfast and lunch.
Sure.
But that's a couple hundred calories. Then we had water, and every school had water coolers. That's all anybody drank. Adults had tea or coffee with maybe a tiny bit of sugar in it, and that was it. Now you bring on the scene in Coke and Pepsi and Gatorade and vitamin waters and Red Bull and lattes and all these new exotic beers and wines, and we've changed. The average American added 220 calories a day to what they drink from beverages in the last 20 to 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And the average American drinks 460 calories a day from beverages, two and older. 20% of Americans drink up close to 900 calories a day from beverages with sugar added. And our system doesn't allow it. We don't cut our food intake when we drink those. So it's just adding our weight to us. Maybe in hundreds of years we'll evolve and we'll develop. So when we drink a Pepsi or a Gatorade or a vitamin water, you'll cut your food down. But it doesn't work that way now. All the research by anybody in the world, except a few people funded by the sugar and the soft drink industries, has shown drinking any beverage with calories, you do not cut your food intake down.
Hmm. And of course, I was struck by your description of your childhood growing up when you say you drank milk, but it might be 4 ounces of milk.
That's at school. We were given that every day for free.
Yeah. But today it seems that we drink, maybe if we drank a glass of milk, maybe it would be a lot greater than 4 ounces, that we would drink more. I don't know.
That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's where the portion size comes in. But the portion sizing, the beverage issue is we used to drink caloric beverages a couple times a day, everybody. Mm-hmm. Today, we drink 5 to 7 times a day. And the sizes have also gone up. But the frequency and the proportion of people consuming caloric beverages has exploded. It may be vitamin water. It may be orange juice. It may be Coke, Pepsi, or Gatorade, but whatever it is, it's just got tons of sugar in it, and it has almost no benefits except the milk. Milk is the only one that we want children to drink, and even some adults, but we want it to be skim milk. They don't need all the fat from the whole milk.
So these changes, in a way, are subliminal and incremental. Huh? I mean, we don't notice them.
Absolutely correct. But the beverage one truly exploded in the 80s and 90s, and that has a lot to do with when we went from almost no child overweight, 4, 5, 10%, we tripled it. We did the same. We went up in a big amount of adult overweight in this country, and it happened in the UK, Australia, Mexico countries. Mexico doubled between 1999 and 2006 the number of calories from beverages, and they are now higher than us.
Let me ask you, what is the distinction, just a technical term here, between overweight and obese? What's the difference?
Well, the term depends on which ethnic group you're talking about. For white Americans, the health implications come. Overweight and obese have to do with how round you are and how big your belly and your hips are. It's a weight over height, and it's a measurement that gives roundness, and it tries to measure the fatness in our body. And except for super muscle-bound people, it works quite well for adults. And it works reasonably well for children. For white Americans, as you move from 20 to 25, and particularly up to 30 and 35, the health risks really go up. For Hispanics and blacks, the health risks start at younger, at smaller BMIs, and Asians even smaller. So that it depends on the population, the health risk of a 25 and a 30. But for a white American, I really am most concerned with a BMI of 30. But for others, I'm concerned with lower BMIs. Mm-hmm. In India and China, you get a BMI of 25, and you're already going to have diabetes and hypertension.
Ah, again, it's body mass index.
Yeah.
Why different in different...
Different groups have their fat in different parts of their body. And that's part of it. It's the fat around the heart and the liver and that area, which is really the most lethal in terms of diabetes and other things. And there are some unclear other racial dimensions to diseases that we don't fully understand. But much of it is where the fat's deposited. Mm-hmm. And it's different. And that's just kind of how we evolved. And so that's certainly the question. The issue, though, with the BMI, it's not hypertension and diabetes only. If it were that, okay, a drug might deal with it in the U.S. The problem is obesity debilitates. It doesn't kill. So you're sick for a long time. You get osteoarthritis. You get bad back. You get bad knees. You get gallbladder problems. You have sleep apnea. You have trouble sleeping. It all works up. People go to the hospital more. People retire 5 years earlier. We have a 30% higher absenteeism rating and disability rating for people who are very overweight and obese over those who are not. So it's the debility of it. And that's what we fear for our children. We estimate right now with the rates of increase of overweight that 30 to 40% of our children will have diabetes by the time they're 50.
My goodness.
It's astronomical.
Now, when we look at the role, again, of caloric drinks, I take it that the calories in those drinks are mostly from sugar?
Mainly. And I don't care whether it's fruit juice, where it's essentially fruit juice concentrate is used as a sugar in many foods, or whether it's sugar, whether it's cane sugar or high fructose. They all add calories. And only with milk do the calories come major nutritional benefits. We recommend you eat fruit. Or eat vegetables if you want to have fruit juice or vegetable juice.
Well, let me ask you, the What is our predilection for sugar? I mean, we seem to eat a great quantity of it, many of us. Yeah. And is that cultural? Is it simply human? Is it biological? Where does it come from?
There's a biological side there, too. And it's quite, we don't have it as clearly understood as we do for the beverage issue. But we know that from early time on, berries, sweet things, had vitamins and minerals people needed. Bitter things were things to avoid that were poisonous. And so we developed a taste for sweetness. We ate berries. We ate fruit whenever they were available. And they gave certain vitamins and minerals that you didn't get from meat or fish or whatever people could find access to. So, yes, we seem to feel in the evolutionary sense that sweetness, which is one of our major tastes, sweetness, bitterness, sourness, and a fourth one, umami. These are our tastes that we truly, and sweetness is one we want. So you give a pregnant woman something sweet, the baby will want it when it's born later. Mm-hmm. You give a baby something sweet, they will like it 4 years later. We know sweetness is an innate preference. Some people have stronger sweetness preference than other, as you will know. So it's not universal, but it's close to that.
And so, of course, we're showered. Sugar is simply, we're packaged foods have it all over, right? And so we have lots of opportunities from the latte in the morning to the Coca-Cola. It's worse than that, you say.
Yeah. You go to, I don't care whether you go to some organic food store or you like a Whole Foods or you go to a Food Lion or a Walmart or a Sam's Club or a Costco, any place you go, you will find 3/4 to 4/5 of every food product have 1 to 6 different kinds of sugar added to them. You will see, just look on every label, and you will find it on quote-unquote organic, super healthy sugar cereals. You'll find it on organic canned things. You'll find it on cheap things and expensive things. It's there. And we don't have a label for it. We tried to get that. The nutrition and health community tried, but the sugar industry, which is very powerful in our country, didn't want it. And so the Bush FDA didn't want to put added sugar on the product labels.
Don't we know on the nutrition label, doesn't it tell us so many grams of sugar?
Yeah, but we don't know how much is added. Natural sugars are there. That's
sure.
Okay.
Okay.
If you buy canned fruit, frozen fruit, you buy berries, there's natural sugar in it. That's fine. It's the added sugars that really are just there that to seduce you, give you extra calories, no benefit. Sugar has just 100% empty calorie. It's seductive. We want it. Mm-hmm. And we have increased so much the sugar intake in our bodies, in the U.S. in particular. But we haven't reduced the amount of sugar from food between 1960 and today, but we've quadrupled the amount from beverages. So back in the 60s, less than a third of our sugar came from beverages. Today, over 2/3 come from beverages. And so it's in the beverage category where we've just added. And in fact, somehow, theoretically, we've become thirstier. We consume the same amount of water today that we did in the 1980s, based on national surveys, representative of the U.S. But we increased 21 ounces on sugary beverages.
My guest, Barry Popkin, professor of global nutrition at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His new book is The World is Fat. That's subtitled The Fads, Trends, Policies, and Products That Are Fattening the Human Race. Back after these messages at WOSU 820, NPR News.
On Talk of the Nation, we talk about what you're talking about.
I turned on the radio and I heard this and I nearly drove off the freeway.
I have experienced a lot of what you've been talking about.
I'm Neil Conan. Surprising voices, interesting conversations on the topics you're talking about. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And on Talk of the Nation later this afternoon, in looking for America's common ground, how to handle our many hard and fast disagreements. Also in the program later this afternoon, after a company lays off workers, What's the workplace like for the people who remain? All of that and much more on Talk of the Nation. It's here from 2 until 4 on WOSU 820, NPR News. Next time on Frontline, correspondent Dave Iverson sets out to understand his own diagnosis of Parkinson's, a disease that scientists believe could hold the key to unlocking the secrets of brain disease. Watch Frontline tonight at 10 p.m. on WOSU-TV. In the weather forecast for today, some sunshine leading to clouds later in the day. There is a 50% chance of snow and with an accumulation of less than half an inch. Cloudy tonight and a chance of snow and a low around 14 degrees. For Wednesday, cloudy, a chance of snow and a high of 22. Currently 24 degrees in downtown Columbus. And now back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line. At WOSU 820, NPR News and nutrition scholar Barry Popkin says there's a global obesity epidemic. The number is more than 1.6 billion people overweight around the world. Billion with a B. Over 230 million have diabetes. More than 1.5 billion have hypertension. We are fat. We are obese. We are overweight. And we're learning some of the reasons why at 614-292-8513. You can email comments or questions to openline at wosu.org. Let's go to our phones. Mark is on the line. Hi, Mark.
How are you doing, Fred?
Good.
I think we also need to take into account the toll that caring for obese, morbidly obese patients has on health care workers. I work in an intensive care unit where we routinely get 400, 500, 600 pound and up patients, and it is very, very difficult to care for these patients, for one thing, and secondly, the increased mortality and morbidity is just astronomical as a result of that obesity.
Yes, comment over here about the morbidly obese, Barry, and their toll on healthcare workers and, of course, their toll on their own health.
Yeah, it's gone to the point where we're talking about 5 to 10% of adult Americans and a few percent of children. I was just looking at that for the children. And the first thing is, even the toll aside from you, it's the toll on the furniture and the beds. Most of the hospitals in America were not equipped for this huge increase in overweight, and it's really been very expensive to re-equip, and many have not done it. There's different kinds of MRIs, CAT scans, things that morbidly overweight people can't fit in. There are chairs that the guests come and break. The effect on health workers, even trying to lift them and move them, it's been a major issue. It's not just in the medical care system. It's been in the ER. We've had to get new kinds of stretchers and things to carry people from their homes and ambulances. It's really a major thing. It hasn't happened in planes yet, but there certainly are problems. Airplanes are starting to talk about charging people for two seats and so forth.
Yeah.
It is, but that's the tip of the iceberg. It's really sad for people in their lives.
Yeah.
They just can't move. People can't walk. They can't work. The cost to the families are enormous. And we're starting to see this in other countries. And it's kind of a cycle. You are faced with so much food and cheap things, and your jobs don't require you to move. You start to gain weight, then it becomes harder to move, and you do more of that. It's a very big social problem, and the discrimination against people who are very overweight is quite serious.
Yeah.
Kids have problems getting dates. They get mocked by other kids. It affects marriages, jobs. At one point, Walmart was going to try to stop hiring anybody who's overweight, but they realized they couldn't do it because that's all they could find. And many, many employers are now starting to give incentives to lose weight or increase insurance costs if people don't. And this is going to continue in our country. We need to find ways to make our workers and our people healthier.
All right. We'll talk about some of those ways as we move along. Sean is here. Hi, Sean.
Hi. I've lost weight through a combination of exercise and diet, and I've gained it back again. And I think my experience is probably typical. And I wonder, my question is, in a society of abundance where food is everywhere and relatively cheap, how do people change their eating habits without changing their psychology? Isn't it a psychological issue.
It's yes, Sean, you're raising a number of good points, and let me talk about the environment side of that. There are a number of countries around the world that are drastically moving to change the environment to deal with this. Starting off, the French got so freaked out by this, they just banned every kind of vending, snack food, everything from their schools. They got all TV with a food and beverage ads off for kids and adolescents. Mexico is working to get really increase the prices of caloric beverages. They've cut out whole milk from all the 20 million people on government programs. They've cut out all access to sugary beverages. They're working quite hard to change the environment. There are a number of countries doing even more drastic things. So the issue is that you're talking about everywhere you move, you have a promotion to drink this, buy this. You find food available. You find ads. You find billboards. People are offering you food. It's a very difficult thing to offset. It's so difficult that I know in talking to people who have tried to do ads in this country for healthy things, they're, you know, you can't afford to. There are tens of billions of dollars spent to advertise junk food in America today. Either we get rid of it, a lot of it, we change the environment, or there's no way you can move through the day and not have so much of it around you.
Yeah.
Now, that's really – and I'm as an economist, there are lots of economic things I see we can do and that we're trying to do, and we might come to that later.
Mm-hmm.
Why not tax the things that are bad?
We are doing that. Governor Patterson is trying to do that in New York. He's proposed to start with an 18% tax. That is what we did for cigarettes. We taxed them. We got rid of advertising. We even for 10 years required that for every cigarette ad, they had to give a half of a dollar, 50%, to an ad to for people to do public health ads against cigarettes. So we can do these things. We did it for cigarettes. We cut the smoking rate by two-thirds in just a matter of a couple decades. We haven't completed that, but we really went a long way. And cigarettes are the most addictive thing. And we could do that for food. We are doing that in some other countries. I'm working with the Mexicans to do taxes. New York State is going to try to do it.
Barry, let me ask you, New York State, what is it that they want to tax 18%? What kind of food?
Well, we're hoping on sugary beverages to
mm-hmm.
start with. That's Governor Patterson's State of the Nation effect. Proclamation. The beverage companies are coming back and trying to go to him and say, hey, there's no evidence that sugar causes obesity. And they promote all their studies. But all of a sudden, if you look at the 500 others and the 400 meta-analyses and the dozens of reviews, it says the opposite. They just cite their own funded research, which is, you know, mm-hmm. not to be believed by anybody. So it's a big issue of dealing with big beverage. If big beverage and big sugar are almost the equivalent of big tobacco in the sense of what they're doing to our food supply.
Mm-hmm. Sean, do you have a quick follow-up question here?
I don't think those things are going to happen anytime soon because of the power of the food industry. In the meantime, people need to figure out a way to change their whole thinking about eating. I know it's hard because it evolved over millions of years, but there must be...
Yeah,
there must
yeah.
be something people can do right now.
And there certainly are things when it comes to drinking. People need to drink water, drink tea and coffee without much sugar, or drink diet beverages. That's the simplest. When it comes to food, it's really pretty hard, and some people make that step. When it comes to activity, we need activity just to be healthy, whether or not we're skinny or fat. So, yes, that would be good to do, but... it's very hard for the mass of America and the world when we removed activity from all their daily movement to get them to all of a sudden create a lifestyle where they can move. And it's happening with a tiny proportion of super educated people in America and a few others, but it's just not happening globally,
yeah.
except in countries that are used to it. And we're going to have to deal with the food supply. I should add, Sean, Maine has a big tax on soft drinks. New York is starting to fight that. We're starting to see that in a number of countries in Asia and elsewhere. It will come. Even my state legislators in North Carolina tell me in 5 years they'll get one because parents are so freaked out by child obesity and diabetes. So unfortunately, it may be too late, and we need it now.
Sean, thanks for your call. Barry, you mentioned the possibility of switching to soft drinks, let's say, with artificial sweeteners. Do those artificial sweeteners, that reduces calories, but do the artificial sweeteners in themselves pose a problem?
Well, we did a very serious review on that published in the Preeminent Nutrition Journal a month ago, somebody from Purdue, Rick Madison, myself. And other than one mechanism, some people who consume artificial sweeteners also use it as a crutch. They go out and eat pies and cakes and fries. Other than that subsample, there's no negative research we can find. You will find little studies here and there that say you eat this and you're going to get cancer or so on. But in terms of all the Food and Drug Administrations of the world and all the careful reviews of these items, they don't find the kind of carcinogenic effects.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really a question, if you use it as part of a healthy diet, it's one thing. If you use it and think you can go out and eat a piece of pie, that's going to hurt you.
Mm-hmm.
And so the people that do the pie and change their diets in an unhealthy way when they drink diet beverages, which typically tend to be overweight people who are trying to lose weight but are really not, they tend to increase their risk of heart disease and diabetes. But the people who don't go the opposite direction.
Yeah. Yeah, now other effects. It took me a while to figure out, and then I did, that every time I drank a beverage with NutraSweet in it, I would get a caffeine-like high, a very unpleasant-like high from it. So I understand that it must be having some effect on me and maybe on others, too.
Oh, sure, sure. Caffeine has...
This isn't caffeine. This is NutraSweet. No caffeine in the beverage, but it has that kind of effect.
I haven't seen that kind of research.
Okay.
Clearly, we know about the caffeine side, but
sure.
I haven't seen, and we didn't find anything like that on kind of neurological, but it could be there for you.
Mm-hmm.
I know some people who swear they can't touch NutraSweet, or they can't touch Splenda, or they can't touch Stevia, and it makes them sick. So there are those kinds of sensitivities of taste that we all have.
Sure.
But I'm talking from all the basic biological, animal, and human research, what we know today. And someone who's not kind of, I don't have funding from any of these sugar companies. I have nothing at stake in it, nor did my colleague. We were just trying to ask the question. The only thing we don't know is if eating all these sweeteners, diet or otherwise, makes us want more sweets. And we have, in the long term, and we have no sense of that as a field, as a society. And so we can't talk about something we don't know.
Mm-hmm. Nutrition scholar Barry Pupkin, his new book, The World is Fat. Barry, 614-292-8513. Barry, you talk about four trends detrimental to our health: snacking, weekend eating, supersizing, and eating away from home.
Yeah. Now, I'll tell you that many of us think snacking's been the biggest shift. We used to have three meals a day in the 50s and 60s. Children were given like a four-ounce container of milk, and preschoolers and toddlers were obviously given meals more often. And that was it. Nobody, maybe someone had a cup of tea or coffee or some water in between, but that was all. Today, we get a quarter of our calories from snacks. And the sizes of snacks for many people are equal to their meals. We're eating all the time. We're eating 5 to 6 meals a day. So we don't have hunger episodes. We just kind of keep eating. And so that's the first trend. But the other part of snacks is they went from healthy snacks, fruits, milk, to salty chips, salty, fatty kinds of fried items.
Yes.
So they really changed in their, what we call them, energy, the content. So that's the first trend. The second that really is profound is eating away from home and eating processed food. And indeed, more than half of the dollar is spent away from home, eating away from home, and another fairly large amount is spent buying processed and prepared foods and bringing it home. We don't cook much. So that's trend two. The issue of supersizing, you've all seen the movies or heard about it, and you've all seen the huge portions of beverages and fries and other things, and it's true. But it's really been in the snacks and the drinking that the supersizing has had the biggest caloric effect. And so that's the third, and the last one is weekend. Weekends are now Friday, Saturday, Sunday for the average adult. And we consume on those 3 days about 120 to 150 extra calories each day. And that is mainly fat and alcohol.
So on a societal level, you know, what are some of the things we can do?
Well, on a societal level, we clearly can deal first and foremost with beverages. That's the area where we have a consensus among the health community, except the 3 to 5 scholars funded by the sugar and beverage industry, that there's no evidence, that there's strong evidence that caloric beverages cause obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. And even the World Cancer Federation came out and said that for 12 of the 15 cancers, get rid of sugary beverages will be one of the best preventive mechanisms. So that's number one. After that, we can start as a society banning caloric beverage. We can ban the ads for these things for certainly children and adolescents where they're kind of vulnerable, and we can work on that. We can't leave it up to industry to say we'll do an agreement, because you may have a good company that will come and, like McDonald's, put salad bars in, and Burger King will come and add a new 1,000-calorie sandwich, which is what happened when McDonald's cut portions and added salad bars. Its competitors came out with huge, huge 1,000-calorie drinks and beverages. You can't – you need regulations on these things. We're going to ultimately need to think about portion size pricing so it's as cheap or cheaper to buy small-calorie meals at fast food as it is to buy heavy-calorie ones. And on the personal level, we can deal with our schools, we can deal with our communities, and we can work to start to make them places that we feel like moving in. We feel where we have clear water accessible, where the schools have good water fountains again, and get rid of the vending machines. And that's not going to be easy.
Well, we have an email here from Tom. It says, please address the dopamine rush that overeating sugar and starch releases that forms the addictive issues, as well as the fact we don't often wait 10 minutes for the full reflex to kick in. Europeans, he says, often eat slower and then feel fuller sooner without overeating. Any comments, Bert?
Well, Tom, there clearly are diets and some major gurus that push eating slowly and chewing your food very carefully and tasting it as a way. And there's one scholar that even raises the question whether sugar could be addictive, and he's shown in mice some of the same kinds of effects you can find with narcotic addiction in mice. But we know that when you eat sugar, you get a very quick increase in insulin, which is particularly bad in diabetics, which is why they drink and eat kind of dietetic foods and low sugar foods. So there is some kind of quick energy rush with sugar, and you don't feel sated. And it doesn't matter whether the sugar comes natural or processed. I don't care whether it's high fructose corn syrup or cane sugar or fruit juice concentrate. You'll get that quick rush, and then it'll go away, and it won't fill you. And so you're right on some of those points. And the question of slow chewing, I don't know enough about that. And the research on that is really problematic. There are some major gurus that push it, and there are others that can't show it matters. So I just don't know what to say there. Mm-hmm.
Barry, we have an email from Steve. He asks, could hormone-mimicking plastics used to package food all over the world today have an influence on the recent epidemic of obesity? He says, I've also heard that diet colas have chemicals that change mitochondrial DNA in cells, which determines how our bodies metabolize energy. Is that a factor also?
Hi. I just actually was at a presentation with one of the senior scholars at NIEHS about some of the chemicals that might be in our food supply. And yes, he's correct. There are possibilities of some of that. This other stuff, mitochondrial DNA and so forth, no one accepts any of those hypotheses and issues at this point. But there are a lot of toxic chemicals in our water and food supply that we're learning about to see what extra effect. In the end, gaining weight is a question of eating more than you expend in energy. Mm-hmm. Whether chemicals affect our appetite mechanisms or somehow slow us down, that's possible. But in the end, it's eating more than we expend, and it's that imbalance. And for diabetes, it's ultimately overweight, plus there's a separate independent effect of activity. Those two things together are the major causes for adult diabetes. So these chemical issues are something we're being studied in great detail around the world, and there is concern about some of these chemicals in the food supply and packaging and so forth. Just recently, somebody brought up a question of mercury and some high fructose corn syrup. We are looking at a lot of these, trying to understand what they do and if they do anything. And, you know, to date, no one would accept that the evidence is there that we should jump out and get rid of something. We found that with certain kind of plastic containers and other things. And, you know, I'd say that except under extreme conditions, like you put some of the plastic containers that have food are in under the sunlight for many, many hours, which aren't allowed in our country, and you'll get some of these deteriorations he's talking about. Otherwise, that's the safe part of our system. It's really the unsafe part is some of the processing of animal and other foods from the farm level into the factories that I worry about the most.
All right. Let's go back to our call. Is it with Barry Pupkin? The world is fat. Kelly's on the line. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Fred. I was not able to break my addiction to sugar until I did a little research and thought maybe I had an overgrowth of yeast that the sugar fed. And I went on a simple program to kill it, and I was able to get, my theory is better absorption of nutrients, and I was able to lose weight and keep it off, and also my emotional stability improved. I wonder if your guest had any research or thoughts on that, and I'm going to hang up today and listen if that's okay. Well,
thanks, Kelly.
Okay,
thank you.
I think these are good and interesting points. Clearly, we are addicted to sugar as a society, and clearly there have been many diets called sugar-busted diets. Many of the major diets say stop sugary beverages, stop eating sugar and anything. Many of them even say don't eat too much fruit initially as part of that. So there is something there. This other thing, this yeast and some of these issues, I clearly cannot comment on. But I will say that as a globe, the sugar people have been very successful. The first agricultural experimentations in the world were on sugar in the 1890s, and we have worked as a globe to make sugar one of the cheapest products out there. And we've created very powerful sugar and beverage industries. And yes, indeed, it is something we as a globe need to worry about. I've written articles called The Sweetening of the World's Diet, and it is something that concerns me.
So there are government policies that work to encourage certain foodstuffs in the marketplace.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it's not the short-term corn issue. It's really been a very long-term issue that in adding making sugars cheap. And even if we made corn more expensive today, like it's happening, it won't affect the cost of beverages very much because we have a half a penny in a Coke of sugar. It's really a trivial, whether it's high fructose corn syrup or any other sugar. So we've made it so cheap today. It's the problem is that we've made beans and fruits and vegetables and all the other healthier foods very expensive relative to everything else by subsidizing the other foods, which turn out for chronic diseases to be bad foods.
Mm-hmm. So on a personal level, we talked about what we can do in terms of our societal level. On a personal level, it sounds like, as you say, it's calories in versus the amount of activity that you do to burn them. And certainly in a culture, as our previous caller Sean pointed out, that offers us food and sugar and fat food and salted food at every moment of the day, it takes an awful lot of self-discipline. But we can do it.
Some people can do it. But with these environmental shifts, when you go to countries like China, when you go across the globe to countries that had nothing, and all of a sudden you change the environment, the cost structure is drastically as it's happened. It's very hard to do, to be aware of these. These things just creep up on you. They're there. They're available. They're tasty. You never had them. That's why the globe in the last 20 years has truly exploded in overweight and obesity. Mm-hmm. And that's why I talk about these environmental changes, the advertising, the marketing, the pricing, Some of these big things that some countries are starting to take a grip on and others are talking about and I'm interacting with, these are what we're going to have to change individually and as a globe if we're truly going to deal with this. We're not going to be able to get people to go back to plowing the soil by hand. We're not going to be able to get people back to lifting thousands of pounds. We need to do it through changing the food we eat.
All right. Let's a couple of quick calls here. One from Marie. Hello, Marie.
Hello. Did I understand you to say that there is some kind of a connection with sugar or sweetness or something like that and cancer? And if so, could you please expand on that a
well,
little?
Well, yes.
I'll listen on the radio. Also, where could references be? Thank you very
okay.
much.
Okay. Marie, if you go to the American Institute of Cancer Research or the World Cancer Research Fund and you find the World Cancer Report from a year ago, they showed that obesity was the major cause for 12 of the 15 cancers, the preventable cause. Cigarettes was for like one, and I don't remember the others. And within that, they said that sugary beverages, through huge meta-analyses of thousands of studies, sugary beverages number one and fast food number two were the two most preventable things that you could deal with to deal with the obesity. They also talk about some other mechanisms through insulin and other things by which a few cancers, some of the hormonal cancers, are affected by the sugary beverages and other things. And that's all in these reports, which you can either download or you can ask them to send you. This is the American Institute of Cancer Research and the World Cancer Research Fund, and they did a $6.5 million five-year set of studies on this topic.
All right. Time for a quick question from Adam. Hello, Adam.
Hello.
Quickly now.
I was just wondering why it's like every commercial that I've ever seen about, like, they keep saying high fructose corn syrup. It's like they keep saying in moderation. On every commercial it says in moderation. Hmm. What's that mean? Like it could cause a problem. It's like if I had a little bit too much, a little bit too less or something like that.
All right. Let's get the answer to that question.
Well, I'm the one who raised the scare about high fructose corn syrup. And for obesity and diabetes, we now know that it's not a scare. It's just any sugar. So any sugar will cause you problems. You will see a lot of websites that came out after we wrote this article about the potential problems with high fructose corn syrup. Blogs are all over saying it's poison. But it's not when it comes to obesity and diabetes. All sugar is equal now. The research has come out, and we've changed our assessment because of all this new research.
Okay, Adam, thanks for your question. Email question, can we change the group health insurance law so that people can be assessed a full surcharge for their increased health risk due to overweight?
Well, we're talking about that. We do it for tobacco. We did it in the 30s. They used to have health chart, weight charts. I probably is going to have to be slow because you can't just assess people now. You've got to encourage them to lose weight and tell them in 5 years if they don't lose down to certain levels that will happen or something. And, yes, this is starting to happen with companies. Insurance companies are starting to get involved. It's happening in a number of countries around the world, and I see it as one of the trends in the future.
Barry Popkin, professor of global nutrition at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His new book, The World is Fat. It's subtitled The Fads, Trends, Policies, and Products That Are Fattening the Human Race. Barry Popkin, thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And the news is next on listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.